We talk about two traits that have to be avoided at all costs. One, because it's so toxic. One, because it's so elusive. And sometimes traits are more dangerous, and you have to gauge them, not just by how damaging they are morally, but how hard it is to see them coming. And some things, yeah, I could take drugs, right? Come on, you see it coming a mile away. You're not going to do certain things just because they announce themselves and they're wrong and you're good boys. But then sometimes there's little traits that creep and creep and creep and we don't see them coming, and then they mold themselves to our identity, and then all of a sudden we become them. And then how do you climb out of them? Okay, so we're going to talk about two traits today to be really careful about. One is, and this is the trait that probably is the hardest to fight. If you're a smart person, I'll tell you why. It's called the trait of cynicism. Right now, what is cynicism? What does it have to do with our parsha? So to understand cynicism, let's see the most extreme form of cynicism. Korach was the radicalized cynicism. When a cynicism becomes radicalized, we call it demagoguery. So let's see demagoguery at work, and then, oh, that's ridiculous, right? I'm not a demagogue. But if you just move the demagoguery a little bit more moderately along the scale, you end up with cynicism, and that's something everyone battles with. So we're going to see things written very large now, and lampoon, and caricature, and Korach, and I'm not that, and you're not that. But I've met people like that, and I'll tell you a person I met was like that. And then we'll shrink a little bit and say, well, wait a second, I'll never be like that, but I also have to be careful that I don't walk down that road, because that's the road of cynicism. Okay? So, we all know Korach's story, right? Korach gathered the mob, fomented them, incited them against Moshe. They're all screaming for Moshe's head. They're all rebelling against Moshe. They're all questioning Aaron and Moshe's selection. But it's how does he foment the mob, right? How does he challenge Moshe's authority? And look at this man. He split the sea. He brought down the Torah. He defeated Paro. He prayed on behalf of the Jewish people twice. He saved them from extinction. Like, how are you going to oppose this person? So you can't oppose him. You have to make a mockery of Torah. And make a mockery of Moshe's Torah. Now, how do you make a mockery of Torah? Torah looks pretty good, right? It makes sense. Well, the mitzvahs and the it's rational, it's moral, and it's sublime, it's eternal. Like, how are you going to start poking fun? How are you going to start breaking down Moshe's Torah in order to get to Moshe? The answer is, every system in the world, and every person in the world, you can always find the flaw if you're just smart enough and you dig. And even if it's not a flaw, you can always present it as a flaw if you're simplistic and you're platitudinous, and you shout slogans. So let's see two different strategies by which Korach is trying to make a mockery of Torah, at least the Torah that Moshe delivered, not anything written in the Torah. And then you'll see how he's able to foment the crowd, and then he'll describe to you what cynicism is. This is an extreme form, and you have to be careful about it in your own space. Okay, so let's read. Here are the sheets. Okay, everyone, please take two sheets. Are they sorted? Yeah, they're sorted. Okay, just two sheets. We'll read a few sources today. Okay? First two sheets. Okay? So, first, how do I know that Korach, the demagogue, is associated with cynicism? Because the Medrash, when it describes Korach, source number one, quotes a pasuk that we all know from the beginning of Tehillim. What's the beginning of Tehillim? Ashri ha'isha shalo alach batzas v'shoyim. You're a fortunate person, you don't follow the wicked. You don't hang out with the sinners. And you don't affiliate yourself with the cynics. So the Medrash quotes that pasuk. Look at source one. So Korach is seen as the paradigmatic lates. Why? Because he's a comedian. Why? Because he's got cynical jokes. What about Korach? It's not a joking matter. He's not telling jokes. He's not being sarcastic. So let's see Korach as an inflated or swelled form of what a letz is. Okay, so we're going to start with source two, which is a medrash, and then we'll go back to source one. And this medrash, you probably have heard the medrash. Have you heard of Korach's? No, it's based part two. It's on page one. Korach gathers the people, and he whips them into a frenzy. What does he do? He pulls out, with drama and flair, he pulls out a shirt from his back pocket. And that shirt is old Tchelis. Now, right away, visually, everyone's interested. He got my attention. Tchelis is expensive. Tchelis is rare, especially in the desert. You're not near any coast where you can collect mollusks and squids. And it's very expensive, and it's very beautiful. I mean, you look at the tchelis, it's just a nice color. It's turquoise. It's just a pretty color. So you flash out this huge toga. It's all made of tchilas. And of course, he's starting to pray, P-R-A-Y, on their anger, because who wore a completely tchilas garment? Do you know who wore it? The Kohen Gadol, and it was called the Me'il. And the Me'il was kula tchilas. So right away, like, why don't we have one of these? But what he's really riling up, and he says, Moshe, come out from your ivory tower with this shirt that I spent thousands of dinars on to dye it all in tchilas. Would I still have to put tchilas in the corner? And he's highlighting the absurdity of tchilas. Person who has an ugly, stinky, rinky-dinky tzitzis like mine, one little strand of tchilas suffices. And here I've got this huge royal robe of royal blue, and I still have to put on tchilas? That's ridiculous. Unless you know the science behind it, that Hashem has a specific function for tchelos on the edge, and the contrast between the tchelos on the edge and the non-tchelos on the garment. You can put a tchelos, but you don't have to. And if you spent even 5 days learning Maseches Menachos, you'll understand what the role of tchelos is and sitz is, and how you can't accomplish that role in the baguette as opposed to the fringes, because even though they're being worn by the same person, they have different functions. We study Gemara, you know how to make discrete distinctions between one category and another category. But he's looking to find the absurd flaw, the loophole, the place where the system seems to crash, and to say, you know what, this system probably doesn't make sense. The system doesn't make sense, and Moshe's just concocting it in the back room, and he's lording it over us, and he's abusing us, and he's exploiting us, and he's lying to us. Or the second thing he does is he brings his tent. He says, I want you to come to my tent. I've got an annex to my tent. Invites all the 150, all the mob. He says, you know what I have? This is where I live with my wife. This is my study hall. Let me show you my study hall in the tent. Now, they didn't have Rashbos and Ritvos, right? They didn't have Rishon. They didn't have Gemara yet. He didn't have the Shas. What did he have? He had Svarim upon Svarim upon Svarim. Sifrei Torah, Sifrei Torah. Maybe he didn't have them yet because he didn't write so many Sifrei Torah. But he certainly had mezuzos, and even if not, it was a conceptualization. He just closed the door with the Megillah out here. Conceptualization. He said, could you imagine, he says, everyone, this entire tent were full of Svarim. I don't just mean Svarim like Rashbos and Ritvos. I mean Sefer Torah, after Sefer Torah, after Sefer Torah. And now he's got their attention because they don't really have the Sefer Torah yet because it wasn't fully written. Only when Moshe dies on his last day does he write all the Sefer Torah. So they say, oh, wow, could you imagine a tent full of Sefer Torah? Wow, that'd be amazing, Karach. I mean, incredible. He says, well, one day we'll have it. Moshe, what do you think? Would I have to put a little mezuzah on the doorpost of this house full of a little mezuzah, one little parchment, two little parshiyos, Shema, Noam, Shema, when the entire home is filled with Sifrei Torah, which are mezuzahs on steroids? I mean, it's every single parsha. And Moshe says, of course you would. And he starts laughing and yuck-yucking it up. Yuck-yucking it. Moshe, it's a big joke. This doesn't make sense. It's ridiculous. I spent millions and millions and millions of dinars to write Sifrei Torah, and I got to put a little... And again, anyone who studied even a modicum of Torah and a modicum of... knows that there's something about being on the doorpost and those two parshios. Sometimes a fragment is more potent than the entire work, and you want to fragmentize the Torah and take out those two parshios, clasp them together, put it on the door. The doorpost is iconic. You pass it. Sometimes more is less. Less is more. So you put an entire Sefer Torah on your door. You won't be Otze because it's too overwhelming. You put two parshas in the door. You would be Otze. Put them all on the bookshelves. You're not so Otze. Put it on the iconic place of the doorpost. You are Otze. He's digging. He's digging to find this situation in which the system, at least to simple people in a crowd who are uneducated, just doesn't make sense. That's one version of the Korach. Let's read a parallel version, but it's the same thing. And then I'll tell you what he's up to and how it affects your lives. It's really important. Okay? Here's a different version. But I got to warn you. Okay? I'm looking around. Do you guys have any tissues? Well, he's going to be a tearjerker. Okay? So if you have to cry, you need to run out in the middle, you're fine. I'll excuse you now. Okay? Don't be embarrassed. Because get ready for a tearjerker. This is Korach. Playing on people's emotions, pulling their heartstrings. He says, I want to tell you a story. Source number Bays, part one. Line number three. Let's read it together. Almana achas haisa b'shchunasi. You know, he says, everyone loves a story, right? Let me tell you about a widow, a widowed woman who lived in my neighborhood with two little orphan children with Goldilocks hair and pigtails, and they're really sweet kids, and they're really suffering the loss of their father. V'hayulat, line number four, sadachas. This poor, starving, impoverished widow had one field, and she worked so hard to eke out a living. Baslacha, so she started, she walked out the first day, she said, I'm going to plow. I'm going to make something of myself. I'm not going to let this world hand it to me. I'm going to recoil and respond. I'm going to plow. Who shows up? Line number four, Moshe comes out with his handlebar mustache. Woman! In some chauvinistic term. Woman, lady! You know you can't plow with an ox and a donkey together. So stop plowing. You think you can plow? I'm here to tell you, you shouldn't be plowing because you're going to get into complications. Okay, she's careful. Boss Lizra, line number five, says, okay, I was very, very careful. Now I'm going to plant my seeds. Who shows up from stage left? Angry, sinister, criminal, serial rapist Moshe. Boss, he's blowing this up. Lady, you think you're going to sow your field without me? What? Not on my watch. Just be careful what seeds you put into the ground, because if you put grapes and grains, it's going to be usher. Okay, she's very careful. She's very accommodating. She says, okay, now I've worked so hard. I plowed following the law, and I've sown following the law. Now I just want to reap. My kids are starving. They're falling apart. They're being made fun of in school because they're being a PPJ every day. Everyone's bringing good peanut butter and jelly every day. This is for my kids, not for me. Moshe comes in. He says, oh, you think you're going to make off with all this grain? Did you forget leket? Did you forget shichacha? Did you forget peah? Okay, in the field, the second that you're harvesting, you got to give all these monies and grains to charity. He says, okay, I'll follow your wishes, Moshe. But now whatever little grain I've gotten, even though I had to pay up, Moshe, I want to make a, you know, heap them up and gather them and count them. I want to make a goren. That's what a goren is. You gather them from the field, you know, organize them. Moshe is waiting for her on the side. Comes with his Uzi and his band of thugs. And he says, lady, did I ever tell you about Trumos? Did I ever tell you about Maestros and Maestro Shekini? So this woman now, we're in line number eight. She says in the middle of the line, I can't take this Moshe anymore. This Moshe's out to get me. I want to plow. He's got rules. I want to sow. He's got rules. I want to harvest. He's got rules. I want to make a grain. He's got limitations. You know what? I'm finished. This Moshe is running me into financial ruin. I'm going to sell the field. I'll buy a cow for myself. I know it's unwise to sell real estate for portable items. I'll just do it because I just got to escape this Moshe. Masa, miyad amda umachra sasada, v'lacha shteke vasos. I said, you know what? I'll buy a couple sheep. I'll be able to use the milk. I'll be able to shear with the wool for my little kids who are freezing in the winter because of Moshe. I'll be able to eat them every once in a while when I want to slaughter them. So I'll do that. Kivan Sheol, do nine number nine. So now she has two sheep and she mates the sheep because she wants to move ahead. Now this is the firstborn sheep. Who shows up? No longer I. Moshe, now it's Aaron. Lady, you know my name? You probably met my brother. You think my brother was mean? You should see what I got in store for you, Aaron says. Hand over the animal. My brother just told you about tenths and tithes. Hand over the entire animal. It's called a bechor. And a bechor goes to me. Good old me. So don't think you're going to get away with it, you widowed lady, because we have no compassion in this religion, and we'll starve you dry and bleed you until you give us everything that we deserve, because we're the authority figures. Okay, well, what does she do? He gives mangaziza. She gives him the sheep, but at least it's the wintertime, and it's freezing, and it's snowing outside, and there's a war. I'm going to share the wool. To share the wool, not share the wool. And Aaron says, you think you're going to share the wool? You're going to share the wool. Give me my portion of the wool. She says, you know what? I can't take this anymore. I got Moshe beating down my back, breathing down my back in the field. I got Aaron breathing down my back with the animals. She says, you know what? I just want to slaughter the animal, shecht it, call a shochet, feed my children one good meal before we die. We have no wool. We have no milk. We have no field. At least a good meal of lamb chops. One good last meal of lamb chops. She shechts the animal. Kivan sheshachta, four lines from the bottom. Amala, guess who shows up? You think you're finished with me, lady? You're not finished with me. Give me the shank. Give me the four. Zroa is, again, a zroa in a bird, in a poultry, is the wing. But a zroa on the animal is the front flank, it's the front leg. Give me the zroa, give me the cheek. Cheek meat is very, very tasty. Give me the cheek meat, give me the keba, give me one of the parts near the stomach. You think you're getting away, you're not getting away with it. Okay? She says, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I got Moshe chasing me down the fields, Aaron looking at my animals, taking all my meat. I'm just going to give the money to charity. I just want to do one good deed before I leave this world. She says, I'm going to make it to Cherem. Who gets the Cherem money? Aaron shows up and says, pass it over. You silly lady. And that's how Korach lamented the people against Moshe and Aaron. See, this whole Torah of theirs, it's just meant to persecute old ladies and their orphan widows. Come on. Really? That's what the Torah is. The Torah is meant to deliver a just and equitable society. The Kohanim are not parasiting off of people. They're serving people in agrarian culture. It'd be like telling you don't earn a living your rest of your life and just live off of other people's donations. You want that? I don't think you want that. It's not a lifestyle anyone will choose. To serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu and live off of donations. No land. To constantly beg for your food because you want to be Kodesh Lashem. And it's not meant to torture widows and to torture orphan girls. Now, could there be a scene in which a particular woman who's into a difficult state and going through a crisis, somehow these laws and these halachas could be overbearing and too heavy? Of course. What would we do? We'd step in. The Kohen would take the truma and give it back to her as a gift. Moshe would take the, would say, okay, you can't plow this way. We'll bring a team of people to help you plow, even though you only have a donkey and a cow. It's not as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wrote the Torah, and what do you have in mind? Let's go persecute orphans and widows. Let's run people into the ground. But every single system of laws, and every single person, and every single organization, everything in life, if you look hard enough, you could either find the flaw, or you can create a scenario in which it seems absurd, if you have enough imagination. And people who are very smart and they're very analytical, it's easy for them to find the flaw. And that's called sarcasm. And its extreme version is called demagoguery. Korach is the extreme version. Korach is trying to attack the entire system. And he's fomenting a huge mob. And he's trying to fight City Hall. And he's saying things that are stupid. If you take a second to think about it, it carries no weight. Come on, really? Any idiot knows that tcheles on a string can't be replicated tcheles in a shirt. Any fool knows that the mezuzos can't be replaced by sifrei Torah. That's just demagoguery. It's just saying stupid things, which when you've got mass gatherings of people that clap for everything you say, they'll just accept it. Believe me, I've seen two demagogues in my life. One, I don't know who was a better one. Trump was an incredible demagogue. I mean, he really perfected the art. He said nothing. Now, I'm not questioning, you may agree with the values that he represented. But as a demagogue at his rallies, he said stupid things. He said things that were totally false, but he whipped the crowd into a frenzy. And his crowd come clapping for him. I mean, just listening to some of the things he said after Corona was ridiculous. Again, you could say I want to vote for him. This isn't a political, this is just a character assessment. You could say that you believe in his party, you believe in his values, you believe that the other parties are more dangerous to morality, more dangerous to Judaism. But as an honest, authentic, substantive, giving information, here's a demagogue. Here's a demagogue. And I'll tell you another demagogue I met. When I went to Yeshiva University, I was a little bit older than you. We're coming back from this yeshiva. I said, I don't want to get involved in politics. I don't want to get involved in protests because these are all very attractive, right? I'm going to change the world. So I'm going to change the world in drips and drabs. I'm going to learn a lot of Torah and try to change the world that way. It's always very attractive to be holding placards and be holding protests. And sometimes you need to go. Don't get me wrong, but I don't want to be tempted to be constantly involved in the protests and the politics. I wanted to be someone that took those years to fill myself with substance. I was just speaking to one of the boys yesterday who's going back to a campus in America. He said, well, yeah, I'm going to be involved next year in adult education. I'm going to be involved in designing the curriculum of all the from Jews on campus, and there in America, they live together, so it's much more cohesive. You don't live at home, you live together on campus for better and for a lot worse. And he said, should we be involved in outreach? Should we be involved in inreach? Should we try to invite people to speak and run programs for the 20, 30, or 40 people that are more serious about their learning? Or should we try to reach out to the Reformed Jews and the Conservative Jews and less educated Jews? He said, look, that's an important question. It depends upon the context. It's not something I can answer just without knowing the scene. But one thing I'll tell you, in general, people your age are very attracted to outreach. And in general, people your age, since you're still assembling identity, you still need to do a little bit of inreach. And I remember Rabbi Sacks, Zichron Levracha, would always say it this way. Think about the next time you're on a plane, and as you're taking off, they make an announcement. If the cabin depressurizes, oxygen masks will drop from the ceiling. Then what's their next sentence? Be sure to apply your own oxygen mask before you assist someone else in the application of their oxygen mask. You guys are all smart enough to know the conclusion of that statement. You're gasping for oxygen now. You're building an identity that will hopefully last a lifetime. And if you divert the resources that you need to build that identity because you want to save the world, or not just will you divert your resources, you may even dilute your identity because saving the world means coming into contact with the world. And let's face it, you're 20 years old, you're 19 years old, you're 20. You're telling me you're 30 years old and married. I don't think there's going to be aggression for whom you are if you meet. But right now, every person you meet shapes your personality. It's still a bunch of putty. You're still trying to shape who you are. And every person you meet is going to have a role in that. Or as I told this boy, I said, you know what? The people that need you to sit and learn for the next couple of years seriously, they asked me to be their proxy and represent them because they're not here yet. But I'll tell you their names. Because when you're on a college campus, you're going to see all these Jews around you, all these people around you, these Gentiles around you. You're going to say, wow, how can I sit and learn? I need to do outreach and I need to be involved in programs and conversations and panels and I need to be involved in BDS. I'm not saying yes or no. I'm just trying to give you a frame for the decision. And you see all these people who need you. And say, how dare you learn Torah when we need you? Let me tell you the people that have asked me to be their lawyers. You know who they are? They're your children who haven't been born yet. But they're going to be born. And they're your wife who you probably haven't met yet. But you're going to meet her. And they're your grandchildren who you still haven't met yet. And you know what they asked me to say on their behalf? They said, please, Moshe, his name wasn't Moshe, they said, please, Moshe, we need you to be a father that's a Talmud Chacham. We need you to be a father one day who can conduct Torah at the table. We need you to be a person who can raise a family of Torah and know Halacha. Please, Rabbi Tarragon, ask our father Moshe, who's going to give birth to us. Ask our father Shlomo, who's going to give birth to us. Please just sit and learn these years. Please don't waste your time. We just need you to be that person. We can't be here because we're not born yet. Rabbi Tarragon, you're our proxy. Go speak to our father-to-be and our husband-to-be and our grandfather-to-be and our community member-to-be that we just need you not to be so involved in so many other things these coming years, because if not, then we're not going to make great Talmidei Chachamim. Mind experiment. Just think about how many people in your shuls growing up you could identify that were serious about Torah and serious about Tefillah and serious about Halacha, and you looked up to them, non-rabbi, and said, wow, that's a really good role model to me. I don't know where you daven, but I can't imagine the number's too high. And whatever that number is, quadruple it. Let's say I saw five people who really, they struck me. I remember when I was growing up, there were three or four in my shul. And they struck me as being very serious about religion. They didn't talk. They davened carefully. Everyone knew they could ask halacha questions to them. They gave the shiurim, you know, between me and Chamariv and Sukkot. Everyone knew those were like the frum people in shul. Sadly enough, I didn't have that many, so they didn't influence me that much. If the whole shul would have been full like that, who knows what I could have become? Who knows how I was hampered because I didn't really take it as seriously as I could when I was in high school. So it's not just your kids, not just your wife, but your community. And they are desperate that you should be spending these 4 years not involved in outreach, but involved in internal development. So what's the solution? I don't know. But you got to make sure it's balanced. You got to make sure it's balanced. I know a lot of guys who go back to South Africa and to Australia, I guess also, there's a mad, mad, mad rush to be madrichim. And a lot of it is because we owe it to the community, because that's it. And that's a very, very sane and cogent argument. But there's a counter argument, which is just as sane and just as cogent. If no one that comes to this yeshiva, if there's not a person who decides that I'm going to learn seriously for 7 or 8 years, then we are just simply treading water in our community. Because madrichim aren't going to be game changers. You're great. You'll help people get closer to Yiddishkeit. But in terms of moving the community forward, what we need is Talmidei Chachamim. And unless we continue to produce Talmidei Chachamim, and again, I'm less familiar with the Australian community, but I know in South Africa, we're trying very hard. We haven't been so successful the last couple of years in continuing the pipeline. But if you look back a couple of years ago, all the Rabbi Kaplans and the Rabbi Kagans, and it's because they made a decision when they were younger, they're just going to sit and learn for 6-7 years. And in their space, they were game changers. So I can't tell you what to do, but I can plead with you not to be simplistic. And I can plead with you, I know we got to this conversation, but I can plead with you that if you have the chops to learn, it could be it's more valuable for you not to be a madrich and to sit and learn. And even if you become a madrich, it's not about being a madrich for Bnei Akiva. It's about how you see the next 7-8 years of your life. Let me give you another example, okay? Literally, the same conversation we're having. I remember when I was in college, I refused to go on any Shabbatonim. I did not join NCSY, which was the equivalent of Bnei Akiva in North America. And people would routinely come over to me and say, don't you think you're being selfish? And when I would tell them, I don't remember if I had the conversation with them, but what I told myself was as follows. And I want you to listen really carefully, because you'll get this. I'm not being selfish. I worked furiously during the week when I was in college. I tried to learn as many hours as I could until I was falling apart. And I tried to take my academics seriously. I needed Shabbos. I needed Shabbos because I wanted to read. And I didn't get to read so much in college because I was focused on math and computers just to get a profession. And I needed time to learn things that I didn't learn during the week. And I needed time to rest and to think. And in my mind, I was going to become a rabbi one day, or a rebbe. I wasn't sure which one. And I told them in 1986, not in an argumentative way, a disputational way, confrontation. I said, I'm not being selfish. I'm being selfless. But not for 1986, but for 2022. Because there may be some boys who want to listen to what I have to say in 2022. And unless I fill myself with content in 1986, I won't be able to help people in 2002, 2012, 2022 right now. I didn't see my life as a selfish life. I just saw that I was specializing in a particular area that was more rare, but it required the type of commitment and devotion and relentless work that fewer people were willing to bring at that point, and I was willing, Baruch Hashem, able to. So I wasn't being selfish. I was being selfless. And I hope that long-term I made a real difference in many people's lives. And if I would have gone on those Shabbatons in 1986 to serve pizza and to go roller skating with the kids, maybe there are other people that would be better roller skaters or equal roller skaters when they went roller skating. That was our big event. Now, it's not one or the other, and don't make it so simplistic, but I'm trying to break this, I'm trying to demythologize this sense that the best thing we could do for the community is go back. You know, it's clear to me that if I knew one of you guys could really become a top-flight Talmud Chacham, it would be obvious to me, and probably obvious to the community as well, that that's the best thing you can accomplish. And they might say you can do both, and that's already a question of the margins and the time and who you are. You can do both, but I'm just trying to stop this one-track thought. So I went to YU, so it's a conversation. I went to YU, and I said I'm not going to be involved in protests and politics. There's one exception. Meir Kahana. Have you heard of him? You haven't heard of Meir Kahana? Read up on him, Google him. Meir Kahana was a very controversial person. He started the Jewish Defense League. It was assassinated in the early 90s by an Arab terrorist in New York City. But he voiced some very, very, what many felt as racist views about non-Jews in Israel. And in addition, he assailed Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Lichtenstein and some of the other big Talmidei Chachamim in YU, because in his mind, they were bringing too much Western influences and corrupting the true Jewish ideas. Western influences such as peace and harmony and respect of the other people and respect of Gentiles. And he really wanted to transfer or otherwise dislocate all the local Arabs from the land of Israel. Now, I didn't protest because of his political views. Like I said, I didn't want to be involved in politics. I protested because of Kavod HaTorah. To say statements about Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and it was in the newspaper, to say statements about Rav Soloveitchik, I just felt like I'm serious about my Torah. And my love for Torah, I have to protest in terms of Kavod. It's the only time, and the truth is, a lot of the boys with me in the base medrash, who were big rabbanim today, we also went to protest. That was like the one protest we all showed up, because we were protesting on behalf of Kavod HaTorah. Oh my goodness, is he a demagogue. He had nothing to say. He would just shoot out these lines. Lines didn't make any sense. He brought 15, 20 people to clap for him. And I still went the art of demagogue. You say nothing, but but you say it in a way that you rile people into excitement or anger or hostility. And I remember I asked him the following question, and I realized you don't ask a demagogue a question. Like, I was a young kid, but I was in the audience and I was trying to like make a point. And I raised my hand and I said, "You call yourself a rabbi, yeah?" He says, "He's a rabbi, Rabbi Meir Kahana." I said, "Yet you go from school to school, from yeshiva to yeshiva, and you only talk, you only give the following shir. Talk about killing Arabs and killing Arabs and killing Arabs. Like, if you're really a rabbi, why don't you give a shir on Hilchas Sukkah? Why don't you give a shir on Dinei Migo? Why don't you give a shir on Basa?" But like, I was trying to show you're not a rabbi. You're a demagogue who's masquerading behind rabbinics. So he looked at me and said, "What's your name?" "My name is Moshe." I was like a 19-year-old kid. "Okay, my name is Moshe." He says, "Moshe, you come to my yeshiva and I'll teach you Hilchas Sukkah." And all the seals he brought in the front, clapping the hand. Said nothing. He couldn't give me a shir on that. He wasn't capable of it. He was lying through his teeth. He's just throwing out ideas. Demagoguery is the extension of cynicism. Cynicism, and now since we have 5 minutes left, let's really hone in. Cynicism is, instead of going, "Wow," you go, "Really?" There are certain things in this world that will inspire you and impress you and exhilarate you and enchant you. People, ideas, experiences, organizations of people, like an institution, when people organize themselves and create something larger than an individual. You will always find a defect if you look hard enough. Every person is flawed. Every institution has its limitations. Every system has its loopholes. And even Torah, which is perfect, in the human world, it's going to grind to a dead end hole because there are certain situations in which it has to be adjusted. And that's how we make takanos, and that's the way. Torah is perfect, but there could be a woman who all the laws of the Torah put her into a bind. And then we'll solve it by giving it stuck or by intervening and finding solutions for her. And you have to make the following decision in life. Are you going to marvel at things? Or are you going to nitpick them into criticism and cynicism? And that will be one of the most fundamental transformative decisions you make in your life. Because if you don't marvel at things, you become a cynic. And if you become a cynic, you know how to reject everything and you're smart enough to find the rejection. And you know what starts to happen? Your noose starts to tighten. You start rejecting ideas and people. And then you've run out of things to reject because you become a rejectionist. And then you start rejecting people closer to you, your family, your spouse, your kids, people who you meant. And you know what happens? At a certain point, you run out of things to reject, but you're already addicted to it. So who's the last victim of your cynicism? Yourself. And then you become a bitter old man. And you've met bitter old men who view the world as pessimistic and gloomy and cynical. And that is not the way to lead your life. Rabbi, if I marvel at things, I'm not a critical thinker, will I be taken advantage of? Of course you will. I'd rather go to my grave with X amount of naivete coupled with Y amount of marvel and excitement. And I'll take the naivete and the being fooled by certain things as a willing and worthwhile price to be someone that marvels and gets excited and sees things positively and is excited about things, even though that's the price. And let me go one step further. I'll take another 2 minutes or so, but please listen careful. When you raise your kids, not just yourself, don't worry about them being critical thinkers. The world will make them critical thinkers. Trust me. No one's living in a bubble. Your kids will be 13 times the critical thinker you are because they'll have 13 times the amount of exposure. Because they'll all grow up even more wired than you grew up. So I see it on my kids. The amount of exposure my kids have is far better. I'm not talking about pornography and curse. I'm just talking about simply exposure to the world. And exposure creates critical thinking and perspective and proportion and wisdom. But first build marvel. Excitement. The ability to be excited. And I'll tell you how. And please listen carefully. I'm not trying to give you these pie-in-the-sky equations. My kids went to local schools. A lot of their teachers voiced ideas that I wasn't comfortable with about religion or about politics. I know a few things. I'm a rabbi. I had a lot more authority than any of their teachers. I never, ever argued about something one of my kids' teachers said with my kids and rejected it or questioned it. Or I wanted my kids to see their teachers as gods. I wanted my kids to look up to their teachers and say, wow, I've got a great teacher. I want to buy into the Masara that teacher is giving me. Will every detail about that Masara be accurate? Nah, who cares? I want the buy-in. I want the buy-in. Because if I'm sitting at the table and I'm constantly questioning, oh, your teacher said that, come on. It's like you're burning your dollars. How much money do you spend to send your kids to school? It's like folly. They just burn the dollars. Well, don't pay the money. Send them to public school. Spend X thousands of dollars because you wanted to buy in. And then you're pulling the rug out from under their buy-in. You're sabotaging the message. Ask every single person in your shul how much money they have to pay for the rabbi. Collectively. The rabbi earns $300,000, whatever. Everyone pays $1,000, whatever. Why would you want to burn your $1,000 by sitting around the Shabbos table making fun of the rabbi's sermon? It's ridiculous. You want it to be a figurehead. Now, will everyone be perfect? Only one person will be perfect, me. Aside from me, I'll be perfect. Everyone's got flaws. Everyone's got flaws. Just take people as they are. Not trying to nitpick them into oblivion. The only time I ever intervened with my kids about the messages they're receiving in school was when Ariel Sharon, who was the prime minister, had a stroke. It was after the disengagement from Gaza. I heard that some of the friends of theirs were dancing in school. And none of the teachers were interceding. I said, that's the moral red line. I've got to stop them from course. You don't dance when people suffer. It's really not a Jewish symbol of the government and the prime minister. Only once. And my kids learn to critique their teachers and to filter out ideas. They'll get there. Don't worry. How you see yourself, how you see the world. Smart people are much more adept at cynicism. About 15 years ago, there was a study in the New York Times. They actually traced cynicism to a part of the brain. And they found that part of the brain was extra large in people that were intelligent. I didn't need the New York Times to tell me that. Because you're over analytical. And you can always see. Some people say, wow, he's great, incredible. You know people like that, right? Think about the following person in your life. I'm sure you have someone like that. Super sweet, super accepting, super excited, super Marvel. They're always, wow, 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 wow. It's probably a girl, right? Wow, wow. And super naive. And you can lose a little bit of that. Because I promise you they have a healthier life than you do. If you're constantly nitpicking. And naivete is a worthwhile price to pay for excitement and enchantment and hijramamut and inspiration. It's worthwhile. In yourself and your kids. Be careful which comedians you listen to. Comedians are somewhere between cynics and demagogues. They're generally very bright. And generally, they're always looking to exaggerate and inflate and swell a flaw and turn it. I studied comedy. I studied a course on comedy, not in comedy, but literature and comedy. There are four or five modes of comedy. Be careful. I like certain comedians. My wife and I listen to some comedians. Generally, I have no tolerance for cynics. I do have tolerance for people who self-efface. Make fun of themselves, make fun of others like in a cute way, not in a way that makes them feel lower. You can tell the difference between biting, sarcasm, anger, vulgar, cursing, or just laughing at themselves, laughing at each other. And at the time, make fun of yourself, make fun of your brother, make fun of your husband, make fun of you. It's all a way just to talk. It's all cute. Be careful. None of you will be demagogues, that I can promise you. But you may be mini demagogues. We call a mini demagogue a cynic. We want to see what cynicism is. Look at the bold face of Korach. He tackles the Torah and he spins it into these tear-jerking stories. And I'm proud of you that you didn't cry. I got to tell you guys, you impressed me. I was crying when I was saying it. Poor woman, orphan kids, handlebar mustache Moshe, male chauvinist Moshe. Come on, it's really sad. Come on, that's what the Torah is. The Torah is rachamim. The Torah is chesed. The Torah is shalom. There are people for whom the system doesn't always work. In any society, there are people who fall through the cracks because of tragedy, because of limitations, and society needs to find ways, whether laws or chesed, to try to put them back on their feet and build them and support them. But it doesn't mean the system is tilted towards exploitation and manipulation. It doesn't mean that the system doesn't make sense simply because there's a difference between the cloth and between the strings, or simply because there's a difference between the house and the doorpost. It's just demagoguery. You're smart enough to find the case and just got to see through these things. Don't be impressed by people who are demagogues. Don't be impressed by people. Be impressed. I'd rather be impressed with people who are less smart and more accepting than people who are more smart and less accepting. Don't be impressed in life by intellect. Be impressed by moral character. And accepting others and being excited for others and by others, that's part of moral character. It's a really important lesson when you go to college. The next couple of years, you've been navigating your way, meeting a lot of people. You're going to know who to be impressed by. Don't be impressed by diplomas on the wall. It's so easy to get diplomas on the wall. It's so easy to be smart. It means nothing. It's just using brain cells, cheating a lot. Moral character. Living life the right way. Living life bravely and selflessly and with moral questioning. It doesn't have to be Jews. Remember in college, I met a lot of professors of mine whose lifestyle I was very, very intrigued by. I was like, non-Jews. I said, this is a person I want to model myself, not to become non-Jewish, but to try to learn from this person about life. And when I found people who didn't strike me that way, I shut down. I could care less how smart they are. Break this cultural addiction to how bright you are. The sooner you break it, the healthier you'll be. Because in life, your intellect doesn't get you places. It gets you diplomas and zeros in your salary. Things that really matter, like relationships, intelligence doesn't make a difference. It's heart and soul and care and compassion and selflessness. Okay. Pizza night, guys. Enjoy pizza. Okay. Thanks for your patience. We didn't get to talk about ambition, but we'll